Welcome to Body Matters Podcast, where we bring to you raw and inspiring content on all things to do with body positivity and eating disorder recovery.
But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as traditional people and traditional owners of this country. We acknowledge with gratitude First Nations communities for their continuing care and connection to the lands or waters with which they have protected for thousands of years. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded.
On this week's episode, I am super excited to be bringing back one of our much-loved guests, director and psychologist here at Body Matters, Sarah McMahon. Sarah co-founded Body Matters with Lydia Turner in 2009 as a way to go beyond the biomedical model in the treatment of eating disorders. Sarah has also worked with organizations such as Lifeline and is a founding member and board member of the organization Endangered Bodies. On this week's episode, we will be speaking about the prevalence and cost of eating disorders in not only Australia, but also globally. So on that note, please welcome back Sarah.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Sarah.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Would you be able to start us off with some self-care that you've done recently?
I've been very lucky, actually, completely spoiled, because my husband took one of my boys away for the weekend to watch the Formula One in Melbourne. And so I was one child down and managed to go to my sister's for the weekend and just had a lovely time with her, with some wine, and all I can say is my cup is full.
Oh, lovely. And the Formula One would have been a great experience for him as well.
Absolutely, and he certainly enjoyed coming to school late on Monday
because of it.
Yes.
So we are going to be speaking about the topic of eating disorders and how they are growing globally. So I guess, what are we kind of seeing with the presentation of eating disorders in the economy?
It's been a really interesting few years, actually, in the context of eating disorders. So we certainly saw a massive spike in eating disorder presentations during COVID. And that was something that was really quite devastating, actually. The prevalence increased, lots of very, very desperate people seeking help. And there were a number of mechanisms that maintained that in terms of fear of food scarcity, brand scarcity, like depending on people's eating disorder rituals and symptoms, being in lockdown, interruptions to exercise regimes, people being isolated. It was a really, really difficult time for everyone. And as an eating disorder treatment provider, it was hard for us as well, because we probably, as far as I can ever remember, have never had such a huge demand for our services. And so dealing with wait lists and really, really unwell people and really limited access to care and treatment was really tricky. And I mean, since that time, a lot of services are reporting a reduction in demand. But I think this kind of reflects what's been seen across the common economy. So it's not just in eating disorder services, it's with any presentations. There's been kind of, I guess, more awareness about things like neurodivergence and perhaps more interest in that specifically. But eating disorders, I think, on the back of COVID and since then, obviously, financial crisis, increased interest rates, inflation, increased costs of living, that I don't think the eating disorders have gone down. But what I have noticed is people, you know, perhaps more minimization of eating disorder symptoms and presentations. And so people not realizing they're as serious as they are. And then people finally accessing treatment further down the line when they're in much more desperate and dangerous places.
Yeah, I think COVID was the catalyst for a mental health crisis. And then, like you were saying, with the financial crisis, that's just contributed to it. And so many people were at that crisis point. And then for something to just keep stacking on and continuing, you can see how it would be growing kind of globally.
Absolutely.
And I guess we kind of saw recently the Butterfly Foundation did produce a research report around the prevalence of eating disorders in 2023. I guess would you be able to talk a little bit about what they kind of found in that?
Well, it's really fantastic. The Butterfly Foundation commissioned Deloitte to undertake this research again. So the last in 2012, they did a really, really innovative piece of research, which is called Paying the Price, and it looked at understanding awareness of eating disorders and gathering really critical data that would then inform policy and practice and advocate for the needs of individuals and families impacted by eating disorders. And so this looked at the cost of eating disorders across a whole heap of domains, so that we really understood the full picture and the full impact of eating disorders. And so this has been revised in 2024, so 12 years later, to get a more accurate snapshot of what is what the eating disorder scene in Australia actually looks like. The number of people, Australians living with an eating disorder, had increased. So in 2012, this was 1 million people that they indicated. Now that they're saying that it's 1.1 million Australians. No, not surprising that that's going up, but I think it's really important to remember, especially when you have disordered eating in the community, that this is very much the tip of the iceberg. I think that we really don't know just how huge this problem actually is. We're still looking for information that can be quantified more easily.
Yeah, definitely. They do say that it could be like an underestimation, and they're just kind of looking at people who are seeking treatment and in the health system for disordered eating as what they're able to use. But there are so many other people who aren't disclosing or seeking kind of help as well.
Absolutely.
And I guess,
Absolutely.
what is the impact of eating disorders, and people's ability to function, and what we're kind of seeing within the report?
The estimated cost of eating disorders treatment was 20.8 billion per year, or $18,000 per person. I think that this is underreported when we think about the cost of treatment. But look, this is kind of assuming that people actually complete treatment and get well. What we know in reality is that a lot of people have trouble finding the right match for them. There are a lot of people out there who are delivering interventions that aren't, working for various reasons. I'm a firm believer that to recover, someone needs to have the right combination of the right therapist for them, the right timing for them, and the right treatment approach. And so people, like the real cost of accessing treatment is absolutely huge.
Yes, definitely.
It's, I would say unaffordable for most people, even with rebates in place.
Yeah. And also, what we're kind of seeing with like the cost of living crisis is the expenses of groceries going up. And what I kind of found was really interesting that the costs for groceries for people who are experiencing eating disorders, such as binge eating disorder, purchasing large amounts of food in 2023 was 443.6 million as an estimation because of a result of an eating disorder. Like, it has the financial implications and consequences from experiencing certain eating disorders, depending on what you're kind of doing as well.
Absolutely. And that's definitely something I say to clients is, the cost of treatment is expensive, but the cost of the illness is worse, particularly if people are engaging in frequent binging, then it can easily add together a couple hundred dollars a week and times it by 52. That think about the time that it takes to drive to a shopping centre to purchase the food, to engage in a binge. That all is a cost. And I mean, this is just binge eating. It's not talking about cost of purging, cost of like restriction in other ways in terms of
Production costs, like
production
your
costs.
ability to work.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. So it's really important to quantify that information as much as we can, because otherwise it really doesn't show the full picture of the burden of disease. And I remember even like 10, 15, 20 years ago, talking to people who were back then spending, $20,000, $30,000 a year on binging, that was obviously when times were the food was nowhere near as expensive as it is now. So it's quite believable that some people would be spending a huge portion of their income purchasing food for bingers.
But the consequences are so immense, even when you aren't purchasing large amounts of food, and how much it's impacting your life and ability to function. And even in the report, like I was saying, it did talk about people's ability to work and function, and they lose those work days and employment because it's so difficult to function with such a strained mental health in today's society that it really needs to be prioritized. I think there's so much talk about the benefits of therapy and how it really kind of changes people's lives and really makes the world of a difference within all those areas that it's just so undervalued. It does need that investment. Like, you do need that investment as a priority.
Absolutely.
And I guess, how might then eating disorders maybe impact loved ones who are experiencing disordered eating?
It's so hard for loved ones when they have, someone that might be their child or their partner, or their sibling or their friend that has an eating disorder, because they're usually suffering in silence, really sort of struggling to access services that they need. Often will not prioritize themselves in terms of their self-care needs, because I guess the eating disorders present as such a crisis, and they're so worried about their loved one, and will really throw everything they can, instead of investing in themselves, throw everything they can in terms of making sure their loved one gets the support that they need. And so we really see their carers and partners, parents, as casualties of eating disorders as well. And siblings, I really feel for kids who grow up with a sibling with an eating disorder, because it has a huge impact on their childhood or adolescence. The chance that they will develop an eating disorder is also high. This is not to blame by any means anyone that gets an eating disorder, because of course we know that they're mental illnesses and no one chooses to develop one. But the legacy can be transgenerational. It can impact on very significantly on the lives of other people.
Definitely. And even looking at financially as well, people, like, if you have adolescents who are struggling, like, you're losing work time because you need to take work off to kind of help, or when someone's in hospital, then you need to take time off to do that. Like, there's so many implications where it just kind of cascades out and can impact families and communities and how you can kind of live well.
That's right. And I think particularly something like Maudsley Family Therapy, where it requires 2 weeks off school, usually for the young person, and then parents to supervise every meal. It's a huge commitment for families. And I think the thing is, it really works when it's delivered well to the right family. If parents are able to use their own resources, but a lot of people aren't in a position for whatever, well, for many reasons. Why that's just not actually viable for them. And so, it's really great to see some more adolescent treatments becoming available where there's less impact on carers. But I think at the end of the day, again, Maudsley is such an important first step in treatment for adolescents, that the cost, even a few weeks off school, parents, maybe having to stop their jobs for a period of time, certainly outweighs the cost of that young person remaining sick for the rest of their life. And in terms of burden of disease, for that young person, then that's an absolutely tragic outcome. And I think one of the reasons why I'm really passionate about working in eating disorders, and there's many, many reasons why I am, but I think so many of the people that we work with have got the capacity to make a complete recovery and live an amazing life, whatever that actually looks like. And not every illness, physical or mental, is truly recoverable.
Yes. And I guess, how are you kind of seeing with clients their ability to kind of come through treatment and support themselves in today's, society and, the cost of pressures of living and working and being an adult? How are you kind of seeing them do that?
It's really hard. I mean, I think generally speaking, my experience is that parents will prioritize their child, if they recognize that their child's very unwell. So parents will usually do everything that they can to help their child recover from an eating disorder. I think for adults, particularly if it's been a long-term eating disorder, in the current financial crisis that, you know, that may not be prioritised as much because it's really more about just getting through the surviving, and that increased financial stress may also exacerbate their eating disorder, which is the concern that some people have. But it's important to remember that the interventions, in terms of the evidence-based interventions or gold standards of eating disorder treatment, rely on therapeutic momentum. So they rely on treatment at a sufficient frequency, so once to twice a week, depending on things like whether weight gain is required. They're intensive interventions, and the goal is to get better as quickly as possible and sustain those changes. And so the thing I would say in the context of spacing out appointments is, you know, how do you do that if that's something that needs to occur because of financial reasons? How can you do that in a way that's not going to prevent therapeutic momentum? And some therapists will be reluctant to engage in a treatment that it doesn't have sessions as frequently as indicated, because the outcomes, you know, it's entirely possible that that person's recovery might be compromised by moving more slowly. And then there might be some other therapists that would be more willing to think creatively about how do you keep that momentum going. And so, you know, some clients, for example, might have an appointment with themselves once a week, where they sit down, pretend they're in a therapy session, review thought diaries or review material that the therapist might have set them in terms of like reading or self-reflection, other sorts of activities that they could do to try and keep the momentum going.
I love that because, you know, what do you do when your therapist is not there? You know, you don't want to try and rely on them so much because treatment does end, and it's kind of like, how are you able to then use those kind of tools and look within like your story, because it's unique in how you can support yourself.
Exactly. And all treatment models and all treatment should build relapse prevention.
Yes, definitely. And I actually saw on the Butterfly Foundation podcast, they had a professor. She's called Professor S. Byrne Austin in the US. And she did say while eating disorders are growing globally, that compared to, you know, the US and Australia, Australia is actually the leading in prevention for eating disorders and advocating for eating disorders. So it's showing like there is some work being done. It's just about how much it's kind of being spoken about.
Yeah, Australia certainly punches above its weight. No pun intended there. But when it comes to eating disorder prevention, and I think eating disorder treatment, like I think we've got a lot of things really to be proud of when you think about our small population in terms of the contribution that we make to research and the contribution that we make to this field in general. And Australia also leads the world in other, in terms of health promotion and with other issues of concern. And of course, the major one that comes to mind for me is tobacco control, where Australia really set the scene globally for the measures that we've been able to take to successfully reduce tobacco consumption.
Wow.
Yeah, so started with civil disobedience in the 1980s with the Bar Grow Up campaign. And so people kind of using cans and defacing, or they say refacing, billboards for tobacco and control. And you think about how that then flowed on to legislative changes around advertising for tobacco, and you know, all of these sorts of interventions which were subsequently introduced in terms of not smoking in cars, not smoking in pubs. It's all happened over a period of time, but been really strategic. And I think it's fantastic that we have, you know, experience such success in such a significant, such a significant concern. Particularly, you know, I think when we think about eating disorders, we're thinking about, you know, some people would say that there's industries that drive eating disorders. So, you know, thin ideal internalization, perhaps being perpetuated by magazines and media, even things like social media now, but diet industry, weight loss industry, gyms, beauty industry. And so for a long time, people have said that, or a lot of people have felt that eating disorders have been, if not cause, the major contributing factor has been the culture around thinness. And so I think one of the nice things with tobacco control is obviously there's a lot of big players that came into that. It's a whole industry that's manufactured and constructed where you have the tobacco giants making more and more money, and to see the government and people in the community sort of standing up and saying, actually, this causes harm, in spite of them lying about their, lying about tobacco not causing cancer, for example, and some of that stuff that we know that they did. I think it's really exciting.
It is. They did a lot of things, but now I guess we've got to tackle vaping. I know Australia is rolling in, you know, trying to ban vaping and trying to, I think they're going to fine people if they see they're vaping and not have a medical prescription. Like, there are these new challenges that come up, but you hope, like, hopefully we've learned something from tobacco and how we kind of approach it. And addiction as well. It's such a space.
It's a huge space. And, you know, not to mention the role of things like social media, like, you know, the regulation challenges around things like that. It's an ongoing challenge, I guess. It has been around now for, the last 20, 25 years or so, but new, you know, as soon as television, radio, print, billboard ads, all of those sorts of things are really child's play when it comes to social media regulation. Yeah.
And it is important when people in social media start to change their perspective, because I know when vaping did come in, no one thought of it as bad, or like it was cool to vape. No one really knew much about it, but it was cool. And now they're kind of seeing the implications with it. They're doing the studies and people are putting up videos. How can you get off vapes? What I'm doing to get off it? Like, it's changed that kind of public perception in a way to work towards that, which I'm seeing like a massive change in a very short kind of amount of time. People really put the dots together.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I'm really, really proud to have been part of is setting up a charity called Collective Shout, which targets the objectification and sexualization of girls in the media. And, you know, all of that was about using social media for good. So using, rather than us blindly sort of following what other people might be saying and thinking that we're the only one that perhaps thinks differently from that, being able to use it as an opportunity to connect with other people, to have a voice, you know, and to be able to activate change.
Yeah, we definitely need that, because I know with, you know, AI coming out, there is like, you know, this revenge porn thing happening to influencers where their photos are being misused, and it's just drawing more attention to like the problems that are coming from social media and how it is kind of regulated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a minefield, isn't it?
It is. And I guess on like the positive side of eating disorder treatment, I guess, how are you kind of seeing treatment, you know, benefit people when they do seek treatment and they take those steps?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons why I love working in this space, because people do recover and people can recover, and the quality of life improvements, you know, they're so tangible. People not spending so much money on food to binge on, for example. People be able to participate in activities that they enjoy. People, you know, even the shift in people's personalities where you see them smiling, laughing, getting a sense of humour back and all of those sorts of things. It's a very rewarding area to work in, because recovery is truly possible for I would say most people, and it obviously becomes harder and harder the longer that you've been unwell for, but that doesn't mean that you can't recover and that there's any reason ever to lose hope in the fact that recovery is possible.
Definitely. And you're in hopefully enhancing like the socializing and that connection and the quality of your relationships with people and family. And that's kind of, you know, we need those relationships to survive and kind of thrive, and how you're kind of working through that process and having the support that is needed can be so important.
Definitely.
And I guess, what do you think maybe needs to change, I guess, in society in order to really look at the growing number of eating disorders?
I think one of the hard things is, you know, diet culture, you know, and one thing is, so related to that, in Australia, I think we've got the sort of so-called obesity industry, the people who are working in that space, weight loss industry, and then the eating disorder industry, so to speak, you know, don't really talk. And so there is kind of polarization, and kind of really real confusion. It would be really nice to see everyone working together. I'm not saying that eating disorders are weight problems by any means. Certainly anyone at sitting at a higher body weight, there's no guarantee, there's nothing to say that they would have an eating disorder. But it's really complicated. So I would like to see some changes occurring there that we start to move forward and learn from other people rather than operate in such a siloed way, which I think really happens in Australia. And I understand perhaps in Europe, and other places it might be a little bit different in terms of the way that they can work together or do work together, I should say. Obviously things like diet culture though, as we see that the epidemic of disordered eating, there's so much confusion around what healthy eating looks like. And the problem, I think, or part of the challenge is that there are so many industries that feed into this. So we're knowing more and more about the role of highly processed food, for example, in food addiction. Again, I think this kind of polarizing that there'll be a group of people that will say, I don't believe in addiction, and there'll be a group of people that will say, I don't believe that people with eating disorders should pursue weight loss, and another group that will say that they should. At the end of the day, we need to be working in line with what our clients think and what our clients want, but also being aware of the bigger picture and the bigger landscape in terms of what research tells us about each of these things.
Yeah, I think drawing attention to, providing education on eating disorders and not demonizing, I guess, if someone kind of wants to lose weight, but just, hopefully they don't have the eating disorder, it's a different thing. And it's kind of how we look at like obesity. You don't want to like, demonize obesity as well. Like you want to be able to have that connection, and support for everyone in like its own unique kind of approach.
That's right. It needs to be holistic, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's happening at the moment.
I think slowly in areas, it kind of, yeah, depends if it's in like modern, like if it's in treatment, modern media, and who's kind of got the voice to speak, I think.
Yes, I agree with you.
And I guess how could people maybe then talk positively about food and body, and kind of, provide more education within each other around the harms of eating disorders?
Well, firstly, I think we need to keep on having conversations about eating disorders. So, eating disorders, I think, are still pretty stigmatized. And so, it would. This is one of the great things about the Butterfly Foundation's report is just, with raising awareness about the fact that this is actually a real problem. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's not a naughty little teenager that wants to get revenge on her parents. It's they're very real mental illnesses and significant concerns. And I think so long as we keep that at front of mind, that that's really powerful and will hopefully continue to drive other change. So then things like social media policies, for example, the way that we the way that we manage food processing, like so long as eating disorders are on the agenda as a serious mental health concern, then I think that that will inform, it does that sort of ripple effect that that informs other aspects of society.
Yes, definitely. And I wanted to say thank you so much for this episode, Sarah. It has been phenomenal and super lovely to have you back on.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the opportunity, Jessie.
Well, that's the end of today's episode. Please subscribe, leave us a comment or a review. If you would also like to learn more about Body Matters services, you can check out our website at bodymatters.com.au. Thanks for listening.